Welcome back to Chapter and Verse. This is episode 7 of our discussion about Acts chapter 15. In this series, we are discussing the topic of Acts chapter 15. What really happened? Through the centuries of Christian doctrine, there have been many interpretations of what exactly happened in Acts chapter 15. How should Gentile believers coming to a faith in a Jewish Messiah apply that faith to their lives? In our last episode, we began the process of examining the words of James, where he spoke at the Jerusalem Council about what should be told to the Gentiles who were responding to the gospel message and joining the ranks of the first century believers. We ended our last episode looking at the admonishment James gave these new believers to abstain from things strangled and from blood. We asked the question, why would James instruct these new believers to comply with this request when Yeshua never spoke about these things at all? We read from Leviticus chapter 17, which spoke about the prohibition against eating any animal that had died of natural causes. Now, I explained that animals that died of natural causes, or who were strangled, or who had died from some type of violent trauma, all these types of deaths of animals fell under the same type of category. In all three of those scenarios, their blood wouldn't have been drained properly from their bodies. Thus, the blood of these animals would have still been trapped within the meat, making it impossible to consume without ingesting that blood, which of course is strictly forbidden. So when James suggests that the Gentiles should adhere to this principle, was he relying only on Leviticus chapter 7 and 17? Not in the slightest. As I mentioned at the end of our last episode, Moshe speaks about this same topic 4 times in his final address to the children of Israel. In Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 16, Moshe tells them, "Only you shall not eat the blood. You shall pour it out on the earth like water." He essentially repeats himself just a few verses later when, in verses 23 and 24, he says this, "Only be sure that you do not eat the blood, for the blood is the life. And you shall not eat the life with the flesh. You shall not eat it. You shall pour it out on the earth like water." Then, 2 chapters later, in chapter 14, verse 21, he says this, "You shall not eat anything that has died naturally." Finally, 1 chapter after that, in chapter 15, verse 23, Moshe repeats one more time for the children of Israel, "Only you shall not eat its blood. You shall pour it out on the ground like water." Do you think that this was an important message for the nation of Israel to grasp? Apparently, it was important enough that Moshe had to remind them 4 times about it. If it was that significant a point that Moshe felt the need to repeat this command 4 times, we should probably pay attention to it. This, then, answers the question that we asked about James's biblical basis for requesting that the Gentiles avoid these things. But we still have a few questions that need to be answered in regards to this topic. First, as we asked in our previous episode, if the Gentiles were not expected to keep the instructions of the Torah, then why was James mentioning these things? If the Torah didn't apply to the lives of the Gentiles who were coming to faith, then why was James instructing them to follow these laws regarding the consumption of blood from Leviticus chapters 7 and 17 and from Deuteronomy? If all they needed to do was simply follow the law of Christ, and Messiah never once spoke about these things, then why would James suggest that they adhere to these dietary restrictions? Secondly, what do these 4 things have to do with one another, and how did suggesting that the Gentiles do these things appease the Jews who were insisting that the Gentiles needed to become circumcised in order to be saved? What ties these things together? Finally, why have I said several times that James gave the Gentiles 5 conditions, when only 4 appear to be listed in Acts chapter 15? These are the questions we hope to be able to answer in this episode. So let's take a look at the first question. If the Torah didn't apply to the lives of the Gentiles who are coming to faith, then why was James instructing them to follow these laws regarding the consumption of blood from Leviticus chapter 7 and 17 and from Deuteronomy? The answer to this question is a fairly simple one, but one that we humans have managed to complicate to a ridiculous level over the centuries, since the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15? To answer this question, we first need to get past that whole, the old covenant was done away with, and all we need to do now is to follow the law of Christ mantra that has been chanted by postmodern Christianity for the last several centuries. Now, we will not be able to expose all the holes in this mindset in this episode, but let's do a quick synopsis of these issues for the purpose of gaining insight into the motivation and justification of the decisions reached by the Jerusalem Council. As discussed in a previous episode, when I heard and responded to the gospel message, I wasn't living in obedience to the Torah at that point. I was lost and dead in my sins. When I confessed with my mouth that Yeshua is Lord and believed in my heart that Adonai had raised Yeshua from the grave, I experienced a rebirth. Yeshua's death upon the cross set me free from the sentence of death that was rightly mine. The consequences of my illegal, immoral, sinful behavior. His resurrection then gives me the promise of being able to experience the same. I will be resurrected unto new life when he establishes his kingdom, and I will dwell with him for all eternity. But Yeshua's death, burial, and resurrection didn't free me from the Torah, because I was never beholden to the Torah in the first place. That's a complete misunderstanding of what Yeshua came to do. He didn't come to set us free from his righteous standard. Like all the prophets throughout the Old Testament, he came to call us to return to his righteous standard. He came to set us free from the consequences of failing to live up to those righteous standards. But that doesn't mean that we now get to live any way we want to. He still gets to make the rules. We still have to follow the rules of his house. The covenants he established with his people are not the same as the Torah itself. One of the biggest errors that's made within most branches of Christian theology is to conflate the phrase Old Covenant with the word law. The two are not the same thing. The law, the Torah, is the righteous standard that Adonai desires that his children abide by. The covenant is the agreement between the nation of Israel and Adonai. That agreement is that the nation of Israel will live their lives according to the righteous standard that he established for them. And in exchange, Adonai will cause the nation of Israel to be his people, and he will be their Elohim. The covenant is the promise to follow the law, not the law itself. The two are not the same thing. If the nation of Israel fails to hold up their part of the agreement, it doesn't mean that Adonai throws out his righteous standard. It means that he is technically released from his part of the agreement. In other words, he doesn't need to make the nation of Israel his people, nor does he need to be their Elohim. Fortunately, he is long-suffering and patient, gracious and compassionate. And even when the nation of Israel failed time and time again, he has always sought restitution and reestablishment of the relationship. But his standards have never changed. The book of Hosea speaks to this at length. Adonai betrothed Israel to himself. She cheated on him repeatedly. Hosea was instructed over and over again to pursue his adulterous wife and bring her back into his home. Despite her unfaithfulness, Adonai has always been faithful to Israel. He also knows, however, that Israel will always struggle with being faithful to him. This is why he spoke through the prophet Jeremiah about a new covenant that he was going to make with his people. Let's take a look at that passage from Jeremiah chapter 31. Verses 31 through 34 say this, "Behold, the days are coming, declares Adonai, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Yehuda, not like the covenant I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of Egypt, my covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares Adonai. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares Adonai. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their Elohim, and they shall be my people. And no longer shall each one teach his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, know Adonai. For they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares Adonai. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more. What an amazing promise. I am so humbled, excited, and in awe that I get to participate in this covenant of promise. As excited as I am about this new covenant, there's some pretty significant details associated with it that most people completely overlook. Let's take a look at those details. First, verse 31 says something that's pretty important. I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Yehuda. Well, to which of those houses do you belong? Adonai did not say, I will make a new covenant with the church. He specifically stated that this new covenant was to be instituted between him and the two houses of the nation of Israel. This would indicate that if you want to participate in this new covenant, if you consider yourself a part of this new covenant, then you must be either Israel or Judah. Israel was the northern kingdom, and Judah was the southern kingdom. Israel refers to the northern 10 tribes, Judah refers to the southern 2 tribes. In both cases, it's the 12 tribes of the nation of Israel with whom this new covenant is made. Even if we were fully subscribed to replacement theology, which states that the church has somehow replaced Israel, then who's Judah? The first flaw in claiming that the new covenant has somehow replaced the law, or our need to abide by the law, is in overlooking with whom the new covenant is made. Secondly, verse 33 states that this is the new covenant. I will put my law within them and I will write it on their hearts. Now, how exactly could the new covenant release us from living by Adonai's righteous standard when it's that very righteous standard that he says that he will write upon our hearts? We've already discussed the concept of the circumcision of the heart in this series. We've talked about how in Scripture the heart represents what we think about when we hear the word brain. Biblically, the heart is describing what your thoughts dwell upon. So when Adonai says that he will write the Torah upon our hearts, he's saying that the Torah will become our very meditation. Like David, who delighted in the Torah of Adonai, the participants of the new covenant will delight in the Torah. They will make it their meditation. The Torah will be a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path, illuminating the way in which we should go. But instead of being written upon tablets of stone, which can be forgotten about, this time Adonai's Torah will be written upon our very thought life and will become what our thoughts are consumed with. This is the exact opposite of what the majority of mainstream Christianity has stated about this new covenant. I recently heard a Christian theologian make the following statements. They said, the Old Testament Mosaic law was always understood to be temporary. Jeremiah 31 and Ezekiel 36 look forward to a new covenant. It's not that the Mosaic law was bad. The law is good. But it was given for a specific period of time and then set aside when its purpose was accomplished. It was never meant to be for all people for all time. But the moral laws we find in the Old Testament were binding on all people, and they're still binding today because those laws are a reflection of God's nature and character. How do we know what the moral law is? I think a good place to start is any command that's repeated in the New Testament. Oh, my word. There's not enough time to address the 15 to 20 holes in this person's logic, but let me point out a few here just real quick. First, please just do yourself a favor and look up in any concordance, whatever concordance is of your flavor, look up these two words, everlasting and forever. If you look up these two words and all the verses that those two words appear in, you will get anything but the conclusion that the Mosaic Law was somehow always understood to be temporary. By the way, when Adonai said that he would write his Torah on our hearts, did he misspeak? Did he mean to say that he'll write the moral law on our hearts, but just the word law came out of Jeremiah's lips. Further, let's just talk very briefly about this moral law. Does this person not speak out of both sides of their mouth when they said that the law was never meant for all people for all time, but then they turn right around and say that the moral law is binding on all people? So only this vague classification of moral law reflects God's nature and character? None of the civil or ceremonial laws reflect his nature and character? You know, the whole be holy as I am holy part? None of those civil or ceremonial laws were focused on maintaining holiness just as he is holy? So many flaws. Then the question, how do we know what the moral law is? And this person answers with, I think a good place to start. Do I need to go any further? Making theological definitions based upon your I think perspective is not sound theology. That makes me want to pound my head against a wall. Are you kidding me here? I think a good place to start is any command that's repeated in the New Testament. So let me get this straight. If I walk over to my neighbor's fence and pull up the posts and move it back 10 feet so that my yard is now larger, that's okay to do now? I mean, the command about moving your neighbor's boundary marker was never repeated in the New Testament, so it's no longer binding, right? How about Exodus chapter 22, verse 27? Is it now okay in today's day and age to curse or blaspheme a judge? I mean, that's not mentioned in the New Testament. What about Leviticus chapter 18, verse 21? Is it now okay to sacrifice children in the fire to false gods? That's not mentioned in the New Testament. How about Leviticus chapter 19? In verse 18, it tells us to love our neighbor as ourselves, right? I mean, that was the second greatest commandment, and Yeshua said that we should do that, right? But what else does it say? It also says, do not bear a grudge against someone. Yeshua didn't mention that part. So because that part wasn't repeated, we're now free to hold grudges against others? How about in verse 26 that tells us not to tell fortunes? Is it okay to go to a fortune teller now because that commandment wasn't repeated in the New Testament? What about verse 29 that tells us not to make our daughters sell themselves into prostitution? Doesn't apply anymore? What about verse 32, about standing up in the presence of the elderly? We don't need to do that one anymore, right? Listen, I could do this all day long. There are dozens and dozens of instructions that are found within the Torah that are not directly mentioned in the New Testament. Are they all now just done away with, forgotten about, simply because they weren't directly mentioned in the New Testament? Of course not. Let's go back to one of those verses I just mentioned, because it brings us right back to the point of this topic. I mentioned Leviticus chapter 19, verse 26, just a minute ago when I was talking about fortune telling. But just before that, it says, you shall not eat any flesh with the blood in it. Uh-oh, is that a moral law because James mentions it in Acts chapter 15? How would we distinguish then between the first part of verse 26 being a moral law not to consume the blood, and then the second part of the verse is somehow not moral law because it wasn't mentioned in the New Testament? Which then, of course, brings us back to the first question we are attempting to answer here. If the Torah didn't apply to the lives of the Gentiles who were coming to faith, then why was James instructing them to follow these laws regarding the consumption of blood from Leviticus and Deuteronomy? Did James fail to get the message that the New Covenant freed us from the Torah? That we now only needed to follow the moral law because the Mosaic law was never meant for all people for all time? Then why would James require the Gentiles to conform with numerous Mosaic laws if that were the case? The answer is because the New Covenant is the Mosaic law, the Torah, being written upon our hearts. It's no longer external. In the New Covenant, the Torah is internalized. It becomes a part of us. When we become participants in the New Covenant, we are persuaded and empowered to observe all that Adonai has instructed us to do. This is reflected, by the way, in the behavior of the typical Christian. If I ask the typical Christian to move their neighbor's fence, or to curse a judge, or to go visit a fortune teller, chances are they would refuse to conform with my request. Why? Because the law has been written upon their hearts, and to do such things would then violate their own conscience. Now, they may not be able to articulate exactly why such behavior would be wrong, but they would inherently know that it is wrong. That's evidence that the Torah has been at least partially written upon their hearts. But before we get too carried away with making the assumption that we're all living in the new covenant now, let's take a look at the context a little closer, shall we? Verse 34 describes a scenario that certainly doesn't exist in today's world. It says, "No longer shall each one teach his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, 'Know Adonai,' for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest." Does your neighbor know Adonai? I mean, your literal, physical neighbor? Do they know him? Does everyone in your neighborhood know Adonai? Why are there missionaries sent all over the world in an attempt to evangelize the lost if we're currently in the new covenant and everyone should know Adonai? Further, if you read on, in verses 35 through 40, Adonai goes on to describe the other events that will accompany the new covenant being instituted, which includes the Tower of Hananel to the corner gate in Old Jerusalem being rebuilt. Has that happened yet? Nope. In the same way that there are still lost people who need to hear the gospel message in the world, there are still things that are yet to be fulfilled that are described as accompanying this new covenant. Am I saying that the new covenant hasn't happened? That's not what I'm saying at all. What I am saying is that it hasn't been enacted in full yet. Let me ask this question just to help put all of this into perspective. When did the new covenant begin? When was it started? When was it instituted? Was it when Yeshua held up the cup at the Last Supper and said, "This cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood"? Was it when his blood was shed during the whipping he received, when he took upon himself the scourging that was due us? Did it start when he was nailed to the cross? Did it start when he said, "It is finished"? Did it start when his side was pierced? Did it start when he was laid in a tomb? Did it start when he arose from that tomb? Did it start when he ascended to heaven? Did it start when the Spirit descended in Acts chapter 2? Did it start when the first Gentile heard the gospel message preached? When did it start? I'll tell you exactly when it started. In the beginning. He is the Lamb who was slain from the foundation of the world. It was always the plan that he would take upon himself our sins so that we might be set free to worship him in spirit and in truth. The new covenant has always been. The new covenant is defined as being Adonai's righteous standards written upon our hearts. Noah was a participant in the new covenant. This is how he knew which animals were clean and which animals were unclean. This is how he knew how many of each he was to bring with him on the ark. This is also how he knew which animals were suitable for sacrificing and for eating when his family exited the ark. Likewise, Abraham was also a participant in the new covenant. This is why it is said of him in Genesis chapter 26, verse 5, long before the Torah was ever given at Mount Sinai, "Because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, mishmeret, my commandments, mitzvot, my statutes, chukot, and my laws, torot." How could Abraham have kept all these different classifications of the instructions that are found within the Torah hundreds of years before the Torah was even ever given? Because it was written upon his heart. David also was a participant in the new covenant. It's why he said so many times in the Psalms that he delighted in the Torah and that it was his meditation day and night. It's also why it was said of him that he was a man after God's own heart. As our late friend Brad Scott would have said, the new covenant isn't new, it's just true. Beyond that, allow me to return to the first thing I said about this. The covenant and the law are not the same thing. The law is Adonai's righteous standard that he desires the residents of his kingdom to abide by. The covenant is that if we abide by that righteous standard, that he will bless us, and he will be our Elohim, and we will be his people. When the new covenant is enacted, it's still tied to the very same law. It's not that the law needed to change. It was the terms of the covenant that needed to change because we were unable to hold up our end of the deal. Unfortunately, many through the centuries have misunderstood this simple reality. These same people and institutions then completely misunderstand the words of the author of the book of Hebrews, and they use that to justify their error. Hebrews chapter 8 is one of the most frequently quoted passages of Scripture when discussing the topic of the new covenant replacing the old covenant. But there's one huge glaring fact that gets completely overlooked. Hebrews chapter 8, verses 7 through 13 says this: "For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. For he finds fault with them when he says, 'Behold, the days are coming, declares Adonai, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares Adonai. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares Adonai. I will put my laws into their minds, and I will write them on their hearts. And I will be their Elohim, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, 'Know Adonai,' for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sin no more." In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. Okay, so there's a lot to point out here. The author of this letter quotes from the same passage in Jeremiah that we just read from. Before we break that down again, though, let's take another look at verse 7. The author of the book of Hebrews says, "For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second." What this verse doesn't say is, "For if the law had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second." It says the covenant was faulty. Again, the covenant was the promise to live by the law. It wasn't the law itself. But then it says in the very next words at the beginning of verse 8, everything is explained with this: "For he finds fault with them." Adonai did not find fault with the law. As David said in Psalm 19, verse 7, "HaTorah yod he vav he tamima." The law of Adonai is perfect. Hebrews chapter 8, verses 7 and 8 isn't stating that the law was imperfect. He was saying that we were imperfect. Us, the ones who were the participants in the covenant. The covenant that we had made with him was impossible to fulfill because we are faulty. So the need for a different type of covenant arose. Adonai still wants us to live according to his righteous standard, the Torah. That hasn't changed. All the new covenant accomplishes is to change the terms of the way that we keep that righteous standard. Instead of a law that's written upon tablets of stone that's easily forgotten, misplaced, neglected, or just plain ignores, as happens so many times throughout the history of the nation of Israel, the new covenant puts that same law, Adonai's righteous standard, within us, where it cannot be easily forgotten, misplaced, neglected, or just plain ignored. When Adonai says, "I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts," he's describing a complete transformation. When this happens in full, it will be no wonder that no one will have to tell one another about Adonai, for we will all know him just as he describes that we will. Has that time come yet? Not completely. This is why the author of the book of Hebrews describes the old covenant as becoming obsolete and ready to vanish away. He didn't say it is obsolete and has vanished. You see, the new covenant, as we saw with the examples of Noah, Abraham, and David, has always been. It has always been available to those who circumcise their hearts. This is a part of the process of becoming a new creation in Him. When we turn from our waywardness and repent of our sin, when we swear fealty to Adonai and to His Son, we are then able to begin to experience the new covenant the same way that Noah, Abraham, and David did. But it's not yet realized in full, as is evidenced by all the unbelievers who still exist in the world. Having been born into a non-Jewish family, I was once a stranger to any covenant, new or old. But once He made me aware of my own sin and depravity, and my resultant desperate need of a Savior to deliver me from my sad state, when I responded in obedience to His calling and repented of my ways, He then adopts me into His household. When that happened, I became a citizen of His kingdom, and I am now subject to the rules of that kingdom. Those rules are found within His Torah. Allow me to put it to you this way. When someone decides to emigrate to the United States and they apply for citizenship, once their application is accepted, they have to take a class. In that class, they're required to recite the oath of loyalty to the United States. This oath starts off this way. I hereby declare, on oath, that I absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty of whom I have heretofore been a subject or citizen, that I will support and defend the Constitution and laws of the United States of America. Once they swear this oath, these immigrants are then legalized as naturalized citizens. They are then expected to abide by the laws of the United States. The exact same thing is true of us. When we confess with our lips that Yeshua is Lord, that is our oath of fealty. When we become naturalized citizens of the kingdom, we're expected to abide by the laws of that kingdom. And that brings us back to Acts chapter 15. How so? Well, the instructions that James expected the Gentiles to abide by were tied to the laws of the kingdom. They came straight out of the Torah, which is the law of the kingdom of Elohim. So as adopted members, the Gentiles were now expected to abide by those laws. This has nothing to do with their salvation, and everything to do with what was expected of them after they were saved. And it also had to do a great deal with Galatians chapter 2 and Paul's rebuke of Peter, which will explain the entire scenario we see played out in Acts chapter 15. But for that, you'll have to wait until our next episode. Until then, shalom.
Hi, I'm Kimberly with Lion and Lamb Ministries, and I am so excited to tell you about our new program on lionandlamb.tv. It's called Come to the Table. You know, some of life's best conversations happened around a table. Whether it's the kitchen table, your dining room table, or even just having a cup of coffee on your couch. On Come to the Table, we'll talk openly about real life issues on our messianic walk, faith, family, and everything in between. And I'll introduce you to some friends of mine who are walking out their calling in powerful ways. So pull up a chair and join me every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on lionandlamb.tv. Come to the table and let's do life together.